ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you think you'd never be caught out by disinformation? Well, cast your mind back. Remember that big story about the bedbugs at the Paris Olympics? Well, that was actually a very effective Russian disinformation campaign. So effective that most people still believe it to this day. G'day, it's Hamish McDonald here. And I've learned that disinformation can be surprisingly subtle and hard to spot. If you want to join me interrogating the dark world of disinformation, stream The Matter of Facts now on ABC iView.
The thing you don't realise until you become a parent is that when you become a parent, everyone has advice and an opinion. And a lot of it feels questionable or not exactly grounded in evidence. And often you're just left with more questions. Should you really ignore tantrums in order to starve them of attention? Will sleep training mess up your baby's attachment for life? How do you help an anxious kid? And what do you do if a young child, when they are extremely distressed, talks about killing themselves? These are just some of the questions you sent us for this mailbag episode of All in the Mind with Dr. Billy Garvey, a developmental pediatrician who first came on All in the Mind in 2025 for an episode called Bad Behavior or Just Misunderstood? What to Know About Kids' Mental Health.
A lot of our manifestations in the younger years of anxiety is agitation, anger, aggression, outbursts. So
now, that episode was one of the most shared on Apple Podcasts in 2025. And so, given the popularity of that episode, we thought it might be a good idea to bring Dr. Billy Garvey back on All in the Mind and let you ask him some questions. So, this is that episode. And a heads up, we do have that rather heavy question about young children and talk of death in the middle of this episode, so just take care while listening. I'm Sana Kadar from ABC Radio National. This is All in the Mind. I will. Okay. All right. Welcome back, Dr. Billy Garvey.
Thanks, Sana. It's great to be back.
So we've had quite a few people write in questions. Are you ready for some?
Amazing. Yeah, definitely. That's wonderful.
We've had questions about babies, toddlers, teenagers, you know, like the whole way through and on everything from sleep training to behavioral issues, anxiety. So let's start with the littlest little ones. Emily asks, I'd like to know what the literature indicates about cry it out or sleep training for infants and how that affects their sleep as older children or into adulthood. Very succinct question, but a very emotional question for new parents.
Yeah.
Sleep training, whether to do it or not. But yeah. What does the literature say about how
definitely
effective it
we'll
is?
We'll talk about the literature, then we'll talk about the real world, and then we'll talk about my personal experience with it. So I work in one of the biggest tertiary pediatric hospitals in the world, and we have an unsettled babies clinic. So we see babies under 6 months that are having a tough time, and we think about the literature and the evidence, but have to apply it into the real world with those kids. The literature around this is really interesting. It shows there is some research that shows that, you know, babies crying doesn't really impact them and it doesn't have this long-term result, and maybe they're learning self-soothing and regulation.
Right, you're not going to mess them up for life by letting them cry.
No, and especially not for short periods of time infrequently. That's the most important bit. Sometimes when I speak to this, my amazing colleagues in child protection will come out and say some mums just really need to walk away from a crying baby. And it's really important that just putting babies down, even if they're crying, is not harming them, especially if it's how you keep yourself sane. Mm. So postnatal depression, 20 to 30% of new parents, really common, and it can really impact that attachment. Because what we care about is not does the baby sleep, we care about healthy attachment. And that's foundations of that are laid in those first few months and years, but it never set. So one of the key things about attachment is it changes. It's not set in the first 3 years or first 1,000 days like some people think. Secure attachment is really just I'm loved and I deserve that love. And you learn that through responsive caregiving early on. So the baby cries, the baby learns that signal, gets support, and then they come. Sometimes babies stop crying because no one comes. We don't want babies to learn that. Mm. So it's a really good opportunity to think, we don't use controlled crying in clinic. We don't use like the hardcore sleep training, just cry it out, time it, those things. What we use is learning what the preferences are for connection and soothing for each individual baby and appropriately giving that a developmental age, understanding that 6 to 9 months is a window where they kind of struggle to understand that just because mum's not in the room, mum still exists.
Right.
So distress, fear, anger, all that stuff is stuff we should go towards.
Mm.
Low-level grizzling, low-level frustration, you can give them a chance to work it out. Now, I think that with mine, if I'm, you know, full disclosure, we have a 7-month-old at the moment that spends most nights in our bed. So I also have the challenge of a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old that wake up through the night, like nightmares and screaming. So I'm rolling
How
off to
you
that.
How are functioning right now?
Yeah, well, it's actually their mom is mainly the amazing one. She works longer hours than I do, and she does a lot of the self-soothing. So because what we're helping Heidi, our 7-month-old, learn is that calming strategy. Now, I fell for the trap with my oldest, with a vet, where we were like, no, she needs to be out of the bed, out of the room. She was out of the room after one night. And I look back and I worry about that. Now, that's a personal worry where I'm like, maybe I've done something wrong. But professionally, I know that by helping her regulate her emotions and self-soothe and improving her sleep hygiene and all that stuff now, there's no permanent damage from what happened back then. It's just that it didn't sit with me personally that well. And I was an idiot because I'd worked in that clinic for years and years and years before I had my first child. But I still fell for the like social pressure to be like, the baby needs to learn to sleep on its own. It'll learn that just by crying and figuring it out.
Right.
When most of the world co-sleeps.
Yeah.
It's just
exactly.
Really Western thing.
It's a very
thing.
Western thing, yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's this weird thing where we're like, the bond we have with our kids is so short-lived in terms of that intimacy and affection. And I think it's this kind of real amazing window. So anyone out there that's doing that or has done that, you haven't harmed them. Anyone who needs to put down a crying baby and walk away, that is completely acceptable and doesn't do damage. And anyone that is co-sleeping and feeling social pressure to get kids out, hopefully be a bit kinder to yourself and gentler and understand that there's a really beautiful bonding thing happening too.
So is it generally all okay whatever you decide to do, or is there like a long-term impact of either choice, whether having them in the room or letting them cry it out and self-soothe?
Well, the extreme, if we go really extreme, is neglect. And we know a lot of the research shows that babies that were just given food and warmth and changed have the highest rates of mental illness. That was like let out of Eastern Europe orphanages. The real risk of not responding to a baby over, you know, thousands of times and ignoring them and letting them cry it out is that they're insecure in their attachment.
Mm-hmm.
And so that anxiety, you know, separation anxiety, stranger danger, all those things happen in the early years. And the decision we make clinically about whether we worry about it or not is it impacting this kid's daily functioning?
So if we distill the advice down for Emily, is it that avoid sleep training, or is it sleep training's okay if you're otherwise responsive? Like, what's your pithy one sentence kind of?
Totally. I would say that avoid anything that says I'm going to quickly fix what's going on with your baby and think about what are my instincts and how do I look at this bub and try and figure out what they're experiencing and what they need and help them learn to soothe by soothing them.
Okay. Are you anti-sleep training?
I'm not anti it. One thing I am anti is like people that put out expensive programs and say, buy this package and it'll be a video of me teaching you how to settle your baby and they actually have no sleep training at all. I'm definitely anti that without being more specific and getting myself in trouble.
Fine. Fair enough. No, I remember a lot of that stuff when I was a new parent and it made me so anxious and the idea of following a protocol and listening to them cry, I just couldn't do it. I just opted out of the whole thing. I was like, no, I will just give away my sleep for the rest of my life and deal with it.
Yeah, definitely. But you've also got to look after yourself. Yeah. Like the hardest thing for me in clinic is convincing parents, often mums, to be like, hey, you need sleep. You need to walk away from bub. You need someone else to step in and look after this bub through the night so that you can get a proper night's sleep.
Okay, the next couple of questions are about tantrums. So Kate asks, I'm a mum of a 14-month-old who is just starting to have tantrums, and we likely have years of meltdowns ahead of us. I wanted to get some advice on whether ignoring unwanted behaviours is really the right approach. I've heard you shouldn't give attention to tantrums because that will just feed those behaviours, but I wonder if ignoring it is effective and kind. I'd hate for people to ignore me when I was sad, but I also don't want to accidentally encourage more tantrums by showing my daughter that they can work.
Yeah.
So back to the attention question and what you do.
So To start off, strengths-based answer, that kid is ahead in their development.
Oh.
So, yeah, that's a little bit early for tantrums.
Oh, really? Okay.
Because, yeah, tantrums happen because kids get the capacity to exert their influence on their environment through they can speak, they can walk, they can throw stuff, they can pull stuff, and they have an awareness of the influence that has. So that's why they start kicking off. It's usually about 18 months.
Right.
So that's probably quite a bright kid who will be ahead, like, in their language or their fine motor development or something like that, that they've kicked off early. So that's good news. Possibly a kid with a sensitive temperament as well. So attachment changes, temperament never does. Mm-hmm. Temperament's dictated genetically before you're born. 20 to 30% of us have a sensitive temperament, big feelings to stuff that happens. I'm like that, I'll always be like that. And yeah, this person is rightfully questioning this advice around ignoring that because it's wrong.
Okay.
I 100% believe that ignoring behavior is wrong. That comes out of like originally the 1930s, actually, what's called operant conditioning, and Skinner popularized it. You know how the guy, the Simpsons principle, like hopeless but strict, Skinner. That's based on an American psychologist who built this theory around like you reinforce what you want kids to do and you just ignore or have negative consequences for the things you want to stop.
Right. I feel like that's the standard advice that I like feel like I've
It's not great advice, though.
Okay, interesting. Yeah.
So if you're upset out in the corridor and you were being like frustrated, annoying, and swearing and acting out, kicking the wall, how would you feel if I just ignored you?
I mean, that sounds like a very embarrassing scenario. So I feel like I'd probably prefer for you to ignore.
Are you going to stop doing it though? Are you going to go, oh, everyone's ignoring me, I'll stop doing it?
Nah, maybe not.
Yeah, because there's a reason you're doing it.
Mm.
There's a reason you're upset, that you're distressed, whatever it is. Even if it's just, I want to be annoying. I want the lollipop. My brother's annoying me and he took the toy.
Mm-hmm.
That's not about saying break the wall, like kick, you know, throw the glass, whatever. It's about what's the experience that you're having and how do I understand that need and then walk you through that experience. Now, if you're dysregulated, I co-regulate you first. And then we think about what's the consequence.
What does co-regulating look like for people who might not?
So co-regulating sounds like this like pseudoscience, but we know through functional MRI that right now there'll be a level of synchronization between you and me. Like we're going back and forward, but we're calm together.
Mm.
Now, if I become distressed and get really upset and like start stuffing things up, knocking the microphone over, you'll start to as well.
Right.
Because you'll pick up that distress that I'm experiencing.
Emotions are contagious.
Yeah. But then if I knock the mic over and you're like, hey, Billy, it's cool. You're doing really well. You know, I'm here to support you. Then I'll come back to calm. And that's co-regulation. And you will learn how to self-regulate yourself in the corridor when you're distressed because someone helped you learn through co-regulation. Kids aren't born with it. You don't hit a certain age with anything and suddenly you've got the skills to do something.
Right.
You have to learn it. Like you don't become 8 and you can ride a bike.
Right.
So the kid who's 14 months old, you have really low expectations around what their emotional regulation capacity is and you think about what's the experience that you're having and then you help them learn that need through simple things like just language. I feel like you're angry.
Mm.
Do you feel angry and hot?
Okay.
And then the kid can go, no, I don't. I'm not angry. You know, and you're like, okay, cool. Well, how do you feel? Like, what's going on? I'm here to help.
Right.
You know, that kind of stuff. And it's not about trash the house. It's about when you're calm again, hey, we're not doing too well today. Look at the house. What are we going to do about it? What do you think we could do? How about you and me help clean it up? And we think about something we can do really well together. You know what I mean? Guide them back. And it's even like, I'm not talking about it here, but the timeout stuff, that evidence was built decades ago as well by this guy called Montrose Wolfe. And it's been completely butchered. It's been like, I'll hold the kid, even worse than ignoring, I'll put them in a room, pin the door closed, and they just dysregulate more. And goes back to the baby that cries and no one comes, that no one's helping them. I use time out with my kids. When they're really struggling, I take them out of the environment that they're overwhelmed by. We go out together. I help them co-regulate and calm. We have to think about consequences and problem solving, and we go back out to succeed at playing with your little brother.
Right. So timeout is something you do together rather than...
Yeah, it's this environment, this challenge is too much. We need to go out, huddle, and go back in again together. And sometimes we come out multiple times, but we keep going back until we succeed. And sometimes we tap out and go, you know what, I'm so exhausted, we're just going home. This playground has not worked, but it's not, you know, on the drive home going, we're never going to the playground again because of how bad you were, or just ignoring the fact that the kid's melted down and thrown something in someone else's face. It's about saying we didn't do that well together, but next time the stretch will be shorter, we'll succeed, we'll reinforce it, we'll celebrate how well we did just in that 5 minutes of play with another kid.
Okay, this next question also has to do with tantrums, but tantrums that veer into much more concerning territory, this question gets a bit heavy. John asks, my son is nearly five. The vast majority of the time, say 99%, he is a thriving, normal boy. He loves swimming, riding his bike, Lego, he has good friendships. He is loved and supported by myself and his mom, and we all live in the same household with his younger sibling, who is 2.5. A few times in the past year, when he has been extremely upset, he has talked openly about killing himself. He has said quite specific things about a proposed method, which is even more concerning. We have taken him to a GP, who referred him to a clinical psychologist, who returned a letter stating that he does meet the criteria for further assessment. We are treating this with a high level of care and respect because we are unsure how serious this is. Simultaneously, we recognize that kids say all kinds of things to gain attention or respect or just to be heard. We are not sure how far to push for an assessment and professional help. Any guidance on this matter would be hugely appreciated.
Yeah, definitely. It's heavy, isn't it? You hear that story and you're like, God, that's harrowing.
Such a young kid, yeah.
Such a young kid. Yeah, and the first thing of that is just like, what's that? How is that family coping? How are those parents handling that? Because that would be so stressful. Now, selfishly, I need them to think about that and work on that because the kid, if I was seeing them in clinic, is my patient, not the parents. Mm. But I can't get them to do what I need them to do if they're not addressing how low, stressed, worried, concerned, fearful they are about that little boy saying that stuff first. So it's a really important bit of it. Mental health first aid, which I'm really lucky to be a part of developing the national curriculum around that, talks about safety as the priority. So we think about how do we keep this kid safe? And it's not he is safe, it's he feels safe. And this kid won't feel safe in the world. There'll be something that's going on, and it's not because the parents have done something wrong. Once again, likely a kid with a sensitive temperament, but there'll be something happening in his world that makes him feel unsafe. Mm. And you have to address that need in him. You have to think about what is the experience is happening. How do we bring everything back so that he feels safe? When we think about how we respond to that, unintentionally some people do the wrong thing. It's just because they haven't been taught better. You know, for example, oh my God, you know how much that worries me? I'm terrified because you've just said that. I wouldn't be able to live if something happened to you. That'd be the worst thing that ever happened.
Right, don't say that.
Well, no, even if it's a 15-year-old, you're putting weight on their shoulders. Mm. You're adding weight, you know, you're adding load and adding stress. And it should be, I'm so sorry that you're experiencing that. I'm here. And holding space with those kids and validating that fear that they have and that lack of safety. And then thinking about what can we do? After we validate that experience, that must feel awful to not want to be here anymore. So sorry you're experiencing that. I'm here and I'll always be here. I'll do whatever we need to do for this to get better.
Mm.
You know, instead of like, or the other thing is life's so great. Look at how good life is.
Yeah.
Like gratitude's a really interesting thing that gets pushed out in the community and can cause harm. Because if you've got a kid who doesn't want to live anymore and you're saying your life's great, you should be grateful for all the things that happened to you.
Yeah.
Like so many of us grew up with like, I put a roof over your head.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's caregiving. That's not love. Some people want a pat on the back because they provide shelter and food and clothes. But the reality is what kids need is unconditional love. And you test that in challenging times, not by patting them on the back and saying, thanks for listening to me.
So the question also is, should they... At what point, if a kid is saying this, should you always be concerned and take them straight for assessment, or can it be within the range of normal attention seeking or whatever, you know?
Yeah, so it's not within the range of normal, like I know how you mean it and I completely understand it. It's not within the range of normal for like a five-year-old to say, I don't want to live anymore. It's just not like some developmental passage that five-year-olds go through.
Right, no, I meant range
totally
of normal because
they're
just
like,
going for the most shocking
thing.
Yeah,
and they're like, really this caused a big reaction when I said it the first time, so I'm going to say it next time when I'm really stressed or annoyed or wanting attention and support.
Yeah.
Totally. But that's what I worry about. If you're kind of sitting there stressed, that's when you meet my clinical threshold, not, well, there's also a lack of interest in other things, there's poor sleep, the kid can't focus. That's classical clinical criteria for anxiety. But the problem with it is that you have to have it for quite a long time and you have to meet this really strict list of other symptoms that are occurring. But that kid is in range of a professional coming in to support them because the parents are like, we're really worried about this. And it might be he's just wanting attention and support. But once again, why?
Yep,
and if he's continuing to do it, that need is not being met.
Yep.
And just thinking about how do you give him a help? The beautiful thing is he's help seeking. So we know that if we think about kids that are struggling, often the first thing they'll do is externalize. They just act out and lash out. Then when that doesn't work or that causes punishments or it gets ignored, like we were talking about before, they'll internalize and they'll just hold it in. tiniest things. Then what happens is they avoid. They go, I'm not going to go there anymore. I can't go. It's too stressful. It's overwhelming me. The first healthy step is help seeking.
Right.
Just saying, I need help. And even just giving that little boy better language around I need help is one of the steps that's really important in emotional regulation so that it's not as distressing as I don't want to live anymore. The reality is that the really high-risk kids are older than that. They're 9, 10, 11 and above. They're the really high risk, but part of that is access, the means, how long they've been unwell for, how severe those feelings are for them. But I'd still want someone who understands mental health first aid and can help these parents to check in with this 5-year-old, and I worry they're waiting a long time to get that help.
This is All in the Mind from ABC Radio National. I'm Sana Qadar, and this is All in the Mind Mailbag Edition. Today, we're answering your listener questions about raising kids of all ages with developmental pediatrician Dr. Billy Garvey. Okay, a question on anxiety. Danny asks, I want to know how to help my 8-year-old manage his social anxiety without therapy. He is very reluctant to get into group activities or team sports or anything where it may involve a group of people. I don't mind about sport, but I don't want this to impact his connections and stop him from challenging himself. Any ideas on how to help him know that he can do this? He just needs to be okay with it not always working out.
Yeah, definitely. So there's two bits to that. There's like, we think about frustration tolerance has the emotional regulation component of it. So it's like, that's how you learn how to be okay with it not working out. But you don't want him to just not get better at socializing. You know what I mean? Just be like, just be used to it. Most of the time you're going to fail. Good luck.
Yeah.
That's not the outcome we want. We want him to succeed. And so we think about often, this is a bit boring, but Zygotsky had this zone of proximal development. And what it's about is like, where's your stretch at? And so like, first time I teach a kid to ride a bike, I don't go, here's the BMX track. Good luck. Mm. You know, I go, cool, let's just have a small little, you know, playful experience with the bike. And we just build up from there. And once it gets overwhelmed, you get stressed, you throw the bike, you get really scared, you fall off. I'll look and say, want to jump back on? But if it's completely overwhelming, I go, sweet, well done, that was awesome, let's try again tomorrow. And it's the same with social development. The thing about social development is we can actually prepare for it even without another kid there. And we do it through story times, the books we read, action figures. Like action figures can be really wonderful and dolls in this space where one of them's like sitting off and really nervous and you're like, what do you think's going on? How come Batman's not cool to come and fight the bad guys together with the rest of the team? What do you think might be happening? He might be scared. Oh, even Batman? Batman gets scared? Yeah, Batman gets scared too. What can we do to help Batman? We can tell him we'll do it with him. We'll go and do a little mission and like win at that. And then Batman will feel brave again and feel like he can win. You know, and then you go back out. The interesting thing, I think, what a lot of people do socially is they're like, cool, we're just going to go to the playground and you figure it out. Or we roll into the birthday party and we're like, we've had a pep talk with you in the back of the car on the way to the party. You're going to be sweet. I get terrified at birthday parties. And the playground at school is the same. It's the last place kids who struggle to socialize succeed. But we just expect you'll figure it out. Just stay on the playground. But it's like if you keep sending the kid who can't ride a bike onto the BMX track and you're like, with time, you'll get it. No, they won't. And a lot of them will develop antisocial behaviors such as unhealthy assertiveness. I'll just take what I want. Or they just hide and they just let everyone walk over them and they get bullied.
Yep.
So how do we step them out? And the play behaviors that you can do is just one other kid, really structured activity at your house. So you go, you're coming over, you can do some painting, we're going to have a snack, and then we're going to play a game. And you go, cool, 1, 2, 3, bang, happens over an hour. How great was that? And then you can talk about it.
This kid is 8 years old, though. Would the advice be a little bit different for a kid at that age? Or?
No, and that's the trap you can fall into is like, because they're this old, they should be able to do this. You know, it's the bike is a good example again.
Yeah.
We meet kids that are like, they're 9, they should be able to ride the bike by now. But it's like, do they have the steps? No, they're really anxious, so we just didn't do it.
Right.
And it's like, cool, well, let's go back to that. Let's go back to there. And if this kid is struggling socially, thinking about what's a small enough stretch, and safest environment, safest relationships, home with a parent there with one other kid, you know, really well. You just get good at that. Mm-hmm. Then you introduce another kid, then you go to that kid's house. The playground on your own, the birthday party, the playground at school, those are the last steps.
Good practical advice. Someone we'll call Julia asks, How do I manage myself with the reality of having raised a child who might launch into failure? My 19-year-old is suffering from burnout, the culmination of living with undiagnosed autism, hypermobility syndrome, chronic fatigue, chronic pain, depression, anxiety, among other things. I feel so guilty about running out of energy to parent her, but I'm scared of what her life might be like when she leaves my care. Who is the person I need to be that is best for the both of us? I also want to care for my husband and two other children with complex needs.
Yeah, I mean, you don't need to change who you are if that's how you're thinking about parenting. You probably need to think about yourself, like thinking about how overwhelming it can be to support a 19-year-old who's neurodivergent and burning out and has chronic health issues. So, yeah, you don't need to be a different parent. I think you need support around you to think about what does this kid need in front of me. And as we're becoming more aware of the needs of neurodivergent kids, we're understanding that accommodations are really important. The important thing about, like, I think a lot of people get lost in, like, the kid can just stay home from school. Or they're so burnt out, they're so exhausted, they'll just stay here. But that doesn't help either, because I meet kids, I still meet probably a kid a week who hasn't gone back to school since pandemic.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So one of the therapeutic approaches we think about is how do we accept how we're feeling? How do we process that? Mindfulness can be part of that. What's the feeling I'm having now? Not why is it there, I need to fix it, but just actually processing that, helping that kid learn you are burnt out and accepting that, radically accepting it is one approach that we talk about.
Just we have talked about radical acceptance a lot on the show recently.
Yeah. So radical acceptance is really important because it's the opposite. It's the antidote to that guilt and shame. Don't you know how lucky you are? You should be grateful. Like it's no, this is what's happening for me and radically accepting it. But then thinking about what are healthy processes to regulate that emotion? What works for me? And then we think about what are the skills that will help us step forward. How do we go back into school successfully? How do we go back into the world? How do we leave our bedroom? You know, a lot of it is social relationships. A lot of these kids and adults don't know how to ask for help. They don't know how to resolve conflict. They don't know how to assert themselves. They don't really understand empathy and compassion. And think about, none of us were really taught this stuff. You were taught algebra, but no one said, this is how to conflict resolve.
Yeah.
You know, objectively stating what happened, how it made that you feel, what's the need underlying that and what's the request?
That would have been really helpful.
Yeah, imagine if someone taught you that. And if that's where this 19-year-old's going wrong, so we have to have specific goals that have to be measurable and not being like, I wish things were better or I wish you listened to me or I wish you left this house. What matters to that kid? I've never met a teenager. I've met teenagers that don't leave their bedrooms. I've never met one that doesn't have something they care about. You find that thing. Like I play video games for this reason because I can connect with a kid because of that. And sometimes the parent needs to be like, what are you doing? Not judgmentally. And like, I'm spending hours watching this anime. And you're like, sweet, I'm going to learn about it. And I'm going to watch it with you. And I'm going to ask questions about it. And then we're going to explore the real world. Hey, there's this thing happening at a Comic Con. And we're going to go to it together. And we're going to dress up as our favorite ones and all that stuff. And
that's
the kid hasn't been
idea.
To school in months.
Yeah.
But you're like, I need to connect with you first.
Right.
I need to show you that I actually don't care about you going to school. I care about what the quality of your life is like. And you prove it through those things, dressing up for Comic Con, sitting there and watching the anime, even if you hate it. Finding common ground, just celebrating our kids.
Yeah.
It's like, it's the most important thing we'll ever do because, you know, it's going to go quick for us. Like our kids will be gone and it's not these harsh lessons of F around and find out.
Yeah.
It's, I just adored you because then that's how they feel about themselves.
Yeah.
And then they go, I'm safe to be whoever I are. I don't need to go to school and mask and be someone I'm not all day.
Yeah.
Because my mum tells me I'm good enough and makes me feel like I'm good enough. And then I go out and succeed. You know, it's just, yeah, if I could change one thing about the world, that would be up there. Like it's just how can kids learn that they're good enough, that we love them for who they are, and then find ways to help them succeed. And that's what it's actually about. You don't get anything like grades or attendance until you step through those things.
Right.
Safe, belonging, celebrated for who they are.
Those are lovely words to end on. Thank you so much, Dr. Billy Garvey.
It's wonderful to be with you. So thanks for having me, Sarah.
That is All in the Mind for this week. Thank you to all of you who sent us questions. We hope you found this episode useful and helpful. And a big thank you to developmental pediatrician Dr. Billy Garvey. You might know him from his podcast, Pop Culture Parenting, where you can learn a whole lot more about parenting through a pop culture lens. Thanks to producer Rose Kerr and senior producer James Bullen. Our sound engineer this week was Antonia Gauci. My name is Sana Kadar. Thank you for listening. I'll catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.